Can you give me the basics?
Well, this book isn't arranged that way. What do you want to know?
Well, why did you disappear when you stepped off the porch? Are we halfway to heaven? Are we halfway to hell? And how long is this going to last?
I don't see anything about heaven or hell. This book reads like stereo instructions. Listen to this. Geographical and temporal perimeters. Functional perimeters vary from manifestation to manifestation. Oh, this is going to take some time, honey.
Welcome to this special Halloween-themed Beetlejuice retrospective series.
It's perfect. Just perfect.
Join Garrett.
I'm the ghost with the most, babe.
Matt.
Barbara, we did call him and he seemed awfully pissed off.
And Adam.
Live people ignore the strange and unusual. I myself am strange and unusual.
As they look at Tim Burton's 1988 film Beetlejuice, as well as its sequel, Beetlejuice Beetlejuice, released earlier this year.
The juice is loose.
Will Garrett's love of Winona Ryder influence his feelings on these films?
If I could just get away from her permanently.
You want me to marry?
But you never ask.
After tearing Burton a new one on his Planet of the Apes remake earlier this year, will the boys find it in their hearts to like one of his very first films?
I didn't want to bring it up. But rather than have you stumble onto it and make another mistake, I'll tell you.
And will known later Burton career hater Matt ever like a Burton film reviewed on this podcast?
So few clients are able to read my mind. They're just not open to the experience.
These answers and more coming up courtesy of Percolated Media.
It's showtime.
Beetlejuice, released March 30th, 1988. Budget was $15 million, box office take of $75 million. And this was directed by the one and only Tim Burton. I've only said his name one time, boys, so I got to be very cautious about how we continue the rest of this conversation. But who would have thought 35 years plus after this movie came out, we would actually be getting a sequel in 2024?
It is amazing to think about, because they were talking about doing this way back in the early 90s. I believe Burton was on record as saying him and Michael McDowell were working on a script about him in Hawaii or something in that nature. And, you know, it just kind of fell by the wayside. And then Burton got tangled up in other things. And here we are almost 30 years later with a brand new one. And I can't believe it myself. I would see things being posted like, oh, look, there's a poster with Winona Ryder on it. And it's actually just like a fan-made poster. Like, we saw those for years. And all of a sudden, they started amping it up. And then Tim Burton came out and said, yeah, we're doing another one. And I was like, holy shit. So, yeah, it's pretty incredible. But before we get to that, Matt, we got to talk about the fact that this was kind of a...
I was going to say, this is as spur of a moment of a retrospective as we have ever done.
Pretty much, yeah. Because we have more alien films to be discussed. We have some King to discuss leading up to Halloween. But Matt came to me and Adam, and he was like, you know what? I know we have aliens. I know we have some Stephen King. But you know what? I think for Halloween, we should do a special Beetlejuice set of shows to set. And I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? This is immediately after Alien Resurrection. If I can talk with Winona Ryder for 3 weeks, I'll definitely do it. So I'm in.
Yeah, and Adam didn't say no, so that's why we're here today. So,
yeah. Adam is the standing one. If he says no, then we're like, okay, fuck it. But he went along with it. Adam, what do you think of Beetlejuice, sir? What's your history with this particular property?
Beetlejuice comes out. I'm 9 years old, I think, when this thing is released. So this is one of those that was a rental or at-home viewing constantly. But I remember so much of the trailers and marketing around this film. I didn't know anything about Tim Burton other than Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And it's amazing because everybody talks of Beetlejuice, but there's a lot of Pee-wee's Big Adventure in this film. And this is the one that, for me, just kind of solidified Tim Burton for me. And it's amazing that a few years later on in life, I would have a best friend who could not stop talking about Winona Ryder. So therefore... We watched this movie a number of times together. It's definitely a part of my childhood, a part of my teens, a part of, this movie has never left me. And I think for a lot of people that watched it younger, it's definitely that way. I mean, it's amazing because I'm trying to think, Matt, was this movie even out when you were born?
No, I was -5.
Yeah, this was one that it not only solidified Tim Burton to the public, it solidified Tim Burton to Warner Brothers, too, because it was the year after he took on Batman. And in fact, he was actually writing it with Sam Hamm when he got the notice for this particular script, and he loved it so much he wanted to take it on. But it's just incredible to me that here's a guy who he did Frankenweenie, he did a few small things, and then he gets Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which say what you will about Paul Reubens, rest in peace, but the guy had a real run in those 80s, man. He was it. And for Tim Burton to take that on and make it into what he did is pretty incredible when you think about it. It's a nerd looking for his bike, and he turned that into quite the adventure. And then he gets this one, comes out. It's only made for, what? How much did you say, Matt? About 15 mil, something like that?
Yes.
$15 million, and it goes on to make about $75 million and is a juggernaut, at least in the States. You know, it was quite the hit. So this is what really made Tim Burton was this particular film.
Well, not only did it make Tim Burton, this movie, more so than Pee-wee's Big Adventure, is, I think, everything that's most commonly associated with Tim Burton's style in his filmmaking is on full display here, outside of the absence of Johnny Depp. If you remove that, I think everything that makes up this movie would be something that has followed Tim Burton ever since he made this almost 40 years later. But I have a different entry point than you people, because not just on my age, but we got to go back to the time when they made animated properties out of everything. Even yes. Things that really were not something directly associated with kids. I mean, this is a few years removed from things like Rambo and RoboCop and even Alien being marketed to children. There was a Beetlejuice cartoon when I was growing up that I caught on reruns. And I saw that well before I had seen the movie. And in addition, one of the original attractions at Universal Orlando was a Beetlejuice stage show. So I had seen that before ever actually watching the movie. So this was not the first Tim Burton film I had seen. But my entry point was different than both of you, which goes to show, yeah, this movie didn't make what Batman would make a year later, but it spawned an F-word. It has spawned a franchise. I mean, there's a Broadway musical. There's a sequel now. There's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, and it's incredible when you think about it. Now, this was released, I was 11, and I remember that cartoon being out, and I was too old for cartoons at that point. I just didn't care when the cartoon was out. And honestly, I got to be honest with you guys, with the exception of Winona Ryder, I have never been a huge fan of this movie. I watched it a lot with Adam. We watch it quite a bit, but it was not one of my favorite films. I thought it was just what it was supposed to be, which was a launching point for Tim Burton. So I wasn't a huge fan, and I know it has quite the following. Growing up, I remember being on cable a lot. This wasn't one that I would rewatch quite a bit. I think in all my life, I think I've probably seen it maybe 6 times.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm definitely on the other side of that spectrum for it. And especially even more so since I've gotten to have kids. I got a daughter who is amazingly loving this film and did from the first time she watched it. And a lot of things with Winona Ryder actually really leaned into that goth style that was the nice 80s, 90s. Enough so that when I wanted her to watch Wednesday, which Wednesday is a big reason that the sequel to this exists, she was like, no, I don't want that fake goth Jenna Ortega. I want Winona Ryder. She's so protective over Beetlejuice. And it's, you know, if this is on in the house somewhere, if it's on TV or if I'm watching it, everybody kind of stops, you know, whether it's a stairwell or walking through and they're at least watching part of the film. So this is one where it's maybe buy it, you know, every other year at this point it gets on. Some years it'll be every year when it's just to get in the mood for the fall season, which is kind of perfect for us right now.
Yeah. Well, speaking of getting in the mood, let's put yourself in the shoes of a Warner Brother executive. You're sitting there and a script comes through your door with the title Beetlejuice. I'm sure a lot of people at that studio were saying, what the fuck is this? And how do we make money off
Yeah. Let's discuss the writer of this, the original writer of this, because he's a real interesting guy. He's a guy by the name of Michael McDowell. He died in 99. I believe he died of AIDS. We're going to be discussing him again. We're going to be discussing him when we get to Creepshow and Tales from the Dark Side, which is the other half of that particular series.
And Thinner.
King. And yeah, and Thinner. He wrote Thinner. King was a big proprietor of McDowell. He really endorsed his paperback novels. He was a horror novelist. And he was a guy who didn't really do too much, but what he did always had a big impact on me. And this particular script, and Matt, I'm sure you're going to discuss this, but it was way darker than what we eventually got.
Well, this movie actually has a lot in common with Batman as far as the script going through a ton of changes. And much like Batman, everyone involved in this movie passed on it initially. Mm-hmm. When you look at the actors, you look at the even some of the people who worked on it. That script, as you mentioned, considerably darker than what the actual finished product is. Not that it doesn't retain any from that script, but there's also some other changes. So that script was done, and then once Tim Burton came on, from my understanding, is that he brought in Warren Scarron, speaking of Batman, to come in and do a rewrite. And Scarron is really the one that changed the tone. He really established the concept of what we'll see the afterlife with how it's presented in the movie. He nixed one of the characters, which we'll talk about. So for a movie that went through as much development hell as it did, at least in the writing sense, we got a finished product that is certainly coherent, which in the case of a lot of Tim Burton movies is not the most common occurrence, especially with what we talked about with Planet of the Apes as an example, where one of the criticisms of that we talked about was it doesn't feel like a Tim Burton movie. Can't say that about Beetlejuice.
No, this is all Tim Burton all the way. And, you know, the conceit of this film is really interesting because I love McDowell's approach. His approach to this was he was a big fan of Poltergeist. And what he did was he did the inverse of what Poltergeist did, where instead of the ghost being the malevolent part of that particular story, let's make the humans the malevolent part and the ghosts the ones who are kind of the victims, shall we say. So I think that's a really interesting conceit, and I really appreciated that approach.
And speaking of approach, you know, Tim Burton, as we talked about, his one feature before this was Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which that is a movie that was really made by a bunch of people flying at the seat of their pants. Almost nobody involved in that project. Tim Burton had never made a feature. Danny Elfman had never done a score before. Obviously, Paul Reubens had been working that Pee-wee character for years before the movie on the comedy. But this was his, in a lot of ways, a passion project for him as far as a lot of the design work, as far as what the movie was actually about in addition to the writing. But there were some changes that we'll get into. I kind of alluded to this a couple minutes ago with the writing. We could have been looking at a very different movie in the same way that Batman could have turned out totally different.
Are you talking about the original director?
Well, there is the original director. There's also Burton's choice to play the title role, as well as
this is insane. Adam, have you heard this?
You know, when I was sitting and doing some of the research more for this one, where I could have a background watch and I could really delve into trivia that I hadn't read in 10 years. Yeah, all the names and all that stuff was like, oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. And it's flabbergasting. Go ahead.
Well, should we say it now or should we talk about it?
No, let's say it right now. All right. Go ahead. So say Burton's original choice.
Tim Burton's original choice to play Beetlejuice was Sammy Davis Jr.
Can you imagine?
Studio wanted Dudley Moore or Sam Kinison.
You know what? Sam Kinison would have been incredible. That would have been an R-rated film.
Well, they would have went through most of their budget going through boom mics because he just yells constantly.
Yes. The other half through blow.
Yeah. I mean, this is the 80s. I mean, it's Warner Brothers. I have expected to see Joel Silver's name on this at one point.
That is an insane choice. But you know what? Burton had a vision. You cannot deny the guy had a vision. And he was able to get Vincent Price for Frankenweenie for his first project. So you look back on it. Of course, nobody is not going to see Michael Keaton in this role. But you think about it, Sammy Davis, man, that's a curious choice for sure.
When you look at Keaton, you know, you talk about controversy, and we did for Batman. Michael Keaton, yeah, he's no, you know, this such a comedic put on for a role. But the comedic roles that he did before this weren't slapsticky in this style. They were really almost sitcom style for the movies that he did. So even getting Keaton in the end and some of the other choices that he got compared to who he wanted, it's inspired when you look at the result of this film, because this has disaster written all over it.
For sure.
Especially for a director who had never seen anything Michael Keaton had done when he was suggested the role. He's like, Michael, who? But he watched, I think he watched Night Shift, and he watched, I think there was one other movie he had as a point of reference. He said, all right, well, let's go with this guy.
Ben Keaton said no quite a few times before he was finally convinced. All these people pretty much said no at one point. Winona said no. Gina Davis said no. Alec Baldwin said no. Sylvia Sidney.
Imagine meeting Tim Burton and you get pitched this script. I'd be calling my agent pissed off.
Yeah.
There's no chance at this point, this year, with this guy who's got nothing to his name other than a kiddie based on TV movie. There's no way it's going to be a hit.
No, and everybody was kind of proven wrong because, I mean, the movie has spawned so much as a result. And it was, not only was it a hit, it won the Oscar for Best Makeup. It was well acclaimed, except for Roger Ebert. I don't think he was crazy about it.
No, Ebert gave it 2 out of 4. Like Ebert.
But on the inverse, Pauline Kael called it a classic.
Pauline Kael fucking gave this a positive review. Can you imagine?
That's kind of the, I mean, we'll get into some of the changes as we get into the movie, but this is sort of as appropriate a time to review this movie as possible, not just because of the sequel, but this thing plays on ABC 31 Nights of Halloween basically every other day.
Which is crazy with this being so attached to ABC Freeform Disney, and it's not a Disney film. In fact, this is only a few years after Disney fired him.
Yep, this was the man who worked on The Black Cauldron.
One of my favorites. Stay tuned.
It's got the most unlikable protagonist in the history of Disney. I mean, that's kind of in common with this movie. I mean, for the title role, everyone talks about how Michael Keaton's only in the movie for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it is a Batman Returns type of move, you know, where your star is kind of second top billed, but way down the screen time.
Talk about the original director. This is somebody we love to rail on.
Well, the only reason why Tim Burton got this job was because of two things. One, Pee-wee was a hit, and he was considered bankable. Why don't you say it, since I spoiled Sammy Davis Jr.?
Okay. Well, now, like I said in the beginning, this was a very dark script. There were so many things that we'll talk about when we get into the film, but there were so many changes made to it. But some things mostly associated with horror than anything. And the person they really went for to do this movie is a guy who had also done Somebody Who Comes to People in Their Dreams. He did a little movie called Nightmare on Elm Street. The guy by the name of Wes Craven was on tap to do this. And he looked at the script and he was like, you know what? I can't do much with this. I'm passing on it. But I think he passed on it to do Serpent on the Rainbow, if I remember correctly. But
yeah, it's either that or People Under the Stairs, one of those two.
People Under Stairs was a few years later. This would have been, goddamn, you talk about a different movie. And who knows, maybe it could have been good. I mean, it could have been a great horror film if he had taken it on. But it's just a different is putting it lightly.
Well, what's not different is the opening of this movie when you see the words, music by Danny Elfman in a Tim Burton production. I mean, this is
the guy from Boingo Boingo.
Yeah, I mean, that was everyone's reaction when you see the opening credits of Pee-wee. It's Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And then the next credit is music by Danny Elfman.
And, you know, when people think about Danny Elfman, yeah, they're going to think about Batman for sure. But this is the type of score people think of, or I think of when I think of Danny Elfman. Because after the 90s, he tried to legitimize himself. He tried to get away from this sound. And he tried doing legitimate scores. And most of the time, they weren't too great. But this is Danny Elfman through and through. This is Carnival's Gone Mad is all you can describe Danny Elfman as, his themes, his music. And it's perfect for this film. It really fits it well.
Well, not only does the music, is it befitting of the movie? I like how we're opening on what you think is this helicopter view of the town until you realize it's actually the model.
Yeah, that's a nice touch.
City. It's a really cool transition. It's funny, this opening reminds me so much of Hocus Pocus, which came out a couple years after this with the font on the names.
You think Hocus Pocus for the intro, to me, I'm like, wow, this is the Batman intro, but with a model. It's the flyover, it's going through, and it's that Elfman score kind of pulsating to put you in the mood. I got so much of the opening to Batman 89 for this. Except and this, Batman Returns.
Yeah, except this one takes maybe feels like it takes half the time.
Yeah.
Because the one thing about this movie that I love, it's 90 minutes.
It moves. I was shocked at that. I thought we would get more time with Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin before things start happening, but it does not take long at all. And I was shocked at the runtime of this. I remembered it being much longer.
I miss the days when a mainstream movie that you go to see, a big crowd pleaser, is only 90 minutes. Nowadays, this one, even the new one, I was shocked it was under 2 hours. I thought for sure that was like a mandate nowadays. Everything has to be 2 hours. But speaking of things I've forgotten about, isn't it so weird watching a young Alec Baldwin?
Yes. So much so.
Different person 30 years ago. Wow.
Yeah. This was a few years before studios tried making him into a star. I mean, he went through a phase where he was in everything. Studios just did not know what the hell to do with him. I will say, I like him in this. I think he's very – him and Gina Davis both are – first of all, they're a great couple. Second of all, he plays what happens – I think they both play what happens to them very well, because how would you play roles like this, you know? You have a maniac for a director, what's going on in his head. He's describing all these little things that he's going to be putting in this film. It's incredible that we get the performance that we do out of both of them.
Especially when you look at it being Baldwin, because can you imagine if he tried to do a movie with Tim Burton today? No way.
But you see him here, he's got a full head.
Keep the guns away from him.
Yep. He's a full head of hair. He's like razor thin.
Yep.
Compared to what he looks like now. But because I'm so used to the 30 Rock Alec Baldwin, that's all I see in my head. And this was at the time where he was becoming a pretty big star, because he did this.
Yeah.
He did Working Girl. Hunt for Red October was right after this. He was really putting his name out there, and that's why he was being tossed around as a Batman possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, we avoided that, and he got the Shadow instead.
Yes.
Which is
it's amazing we have both Batman and the Shadow in this.
Which is a movie I do have a soft spot for it. But on the flip side, you have Gina Davis, who was no stranger to weird shit because she had just made The Fly.
Yeah, and she was married to Jeff Goldblum, so she was used to weird at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure she saw the script. She's like, you had me at insects.
But she turned it down, too. Tim Burton had to personally convince all of these people to be in this. And she's good, too. I really do like her. I think you put her in these situations, and it went with The Fly as well. Again, how would you react to it? And I think what she does in this movie, and, you know, we'll get to the younger protagonist here in a bit, but I think the way she handles all these interactions are great.
Well, I think what's really effective about this movie, and I've been very critical of Tim Burton when it comes to him being a storyteller. I've said, actually, for the last 20 years, he should stop directing and just become a production designer, because it's clear he doesn't care about story and narrative. But for a movie that's as airtight as this is, I think you get just enough of their backstory to understand who they are as a couple, where they're very, very introverted. You know, they're sort of the opposite of, like, gentrification, where they just want to be very insulary into themselves. And there's that one little line that the realtor has about starting a family. You can see that touches a nerve, so clearly you can infer they've tried to have kids. It just hasn't worked. Like, I think everything that's established here, it's more than enough. And for a movie that doesn't have a lot of fat on it, I think this does a good job of giving you everything you need to know.
These first couple minutes set up the characters, set up the type of people they are. It sets up that they've tried to have a child but can't for one reason or another. The details aren't important. It is very economical in bringing you into this world and making you feel what's going on. And I think that's a testament. Like, it's this opening 5-10 minutes is brilliantly, I'll say, edited, you know, because that really is just a testament to how it moves and moves and moves. And I, Garrett, to your point, and Matt as well, I forgot how effortlessly and quick this puts you into the world.
What else puts you in the mood is the music that is almost as famous as Tim Burton himself, this Harry Belafonte collection that they're both really into. He might as well have a starring credit in this movie.
I know.
Like, this is very much like Prince and Batman.
Yeah, good point. And much like Prince and Batman, he didn't want to include it. He didn't like it. And test audiences loved it, so he kept it in. And you know what? This movie, like you said, Matt, is just as famous for the title character as it is for this song and this and Harry Belafonte. I think it melds perfectly with the world that it's included in.
Yeah, it's an odd marriage, especially because this movie takes place in Connecticut. And as someone who lived in Rhode Island, Connecticut really doesn't look like that. Like this.
I was going to ask you about that, actually.
This feels very like Midwest-y, especially when you learn why the Dietzes are going, because they're coming from New York City, which is obviously the antithesis of this. But from New York City to Connecticut, it'd make more sense if they were moving to like Kansas City, because you're still within driving distance of New York City if you go to Connecticut. But I like how it's this small town where hardly anybody lives there. They run like a hardware store for their job, for their livelihood. And there's the little foreshadowing where they almost hit the dog when he gets out of the car. And there's that small town idealistic thing of the old man just sitting there telling his story. And he goes on for so long that he doesn't realize that Alec Baldwin went inside.
A detail I had completely forgotten about. Again, I hadn't seen this movie too much, but this guy on the outside of the gas station or outside of the store as he's walking by, and he's still talking. There are people like that. Again, I lived in a small town like this. I have seen this kind of shit. This is the kind of people who hang out there, and they think everybody wants to hear every word they have to say. And it's remarkable the way this is played.
I mean, it's very apropos. This might as well be Salem's Lot.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Damn it. I was just about to say that. Maybe it's because we've gone through so many recently, but I'm like, man, this feels like I'm back in a King universe with just the way this town is set up.
Well, especially with the house on the hill.
Yep.
So they're driving along and they're talking about how maybe they should go to like Jamaica to enjoy a proper vacation because they've chosen to just stay home and work on their country home. But Barbara swerves out of the way to avoid the dog. It's no secret Burton loves cartoons. And they do the thing almost like Roadrunner, where the dog is standing on the board, and as soon as it gets off, that's what causes the car to flip. And he's looking at them as he does it.
Total cartoony. There's a moment later on that I swear is taken directly from a Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote cartoon. It's amazing that you watch these people die and you're not feeling sad. It takes you a moment because you don't realize they die. But yeah, it's so cartoony. It's so playful in the way that it's done. And this bridge, this covered bridge, it also takes me... It's amazing because wait a couple years, ride into Sleepy Hollow, because that's exactly the limit for the Headless Horseman is a covered bridge.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Interesting. You said a key word, though. We don't see them die. However, if you read the original script, you watch them drown. And apparently Barbara's arm was supposed to be severed. And that's why there's that line later on about her arm feeling cold. That was supposed to be because it was severed as they collapsed into the water. But here you don't see them die, which I think was the correct decision given the tone of this movie.
Oh, for sure. And not only that, you heard them scream in agony as they were drowning in the water, too. I mean, it was a deep, dark script, and Burton was wise to cut that out in. I believe Warren Scarron was another one. You know, he brought Warren Scarron in because Burton and Michael McDowell, for some reason, just did not get along on this. Even though they worked later on Nightmare Before Christmas, they did not get along that much on this. So Burton brought Warren Scarron on, and I think that's a nice touch where, you know what, we don't need to see that. And don't forget, too, I mean, this is going to really come into play later, but this is a PG movie, so nobody wants to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it also helps that we're discovering they're dead at the same time as the character. Because, you watch that fall, and it's certainly plausible they could have died, but it's not like they fell, you know, off the Golden Gate Bridge and the car would have just, you know, sunk to the bottom immediately. Camera cuts, they walk back into their house soaking wet, which is a detail that Tim Burton still gets asked questions about to this day.
Yes.
That someone said they should just be soaking wet the entire movie. He's like, we had a hard enough time getting our actors to stay on board. You really think we could have kept them if we spoused them with water before every take? I mean, it's one of those little, like, fun leaps of logic that you just have to go with. But they realize, so they realize they have no reflection. They realize that they don't even remember how they got home. Adam tries to leave the house, and he winds up in the sands of Dune.
Yes.
Not just because they're sandworms, as we find out, but it turns out that not only are they dead, but they are basically assigned a house to haunt.
Yeah, and we need to discuss this, too. We need to discuss the effects on this, because I think this movie... I mean, I just edited the Aliens podcast, and I did not remember just how harsh I was on the effects in that movie. And the effects in this, here's the thing about it. Burton had $1 million to work with the effects budget. And I think he rebelled in that because I think he wanted to show the B-movie level effects that he grew up on. And, you know, Burton will really work with that throughout the course of his career, in the early stages at least. And you know what? I think for this movie, unlike Aliens, I think for this movie it works. I think the effects here, while they're not astounding, they're perfect for, again, everything about this movie. It's perfect for the story that they're trying to tell.
Well, they match the absurd cartoonishness of the rest of the movie.
Yes.
I think that's why there's no disconnect. And I can't really criticize the effects, not just because of the budget that they were given, but it's very clear they have Burton has a love for Ray Harryhausen and those old stop-motion creature features. So I think it matches the environment that the movie is set in, and it matches the tone. I think it would have been a huge juxtaposition if they kept the original script and you had these outlandish, goofy effects. I think there would have been an issue that way.
For sure.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the things that if this was effects laden in a different way, I don't think this would be as revered and loved today, because there is something much like the Harryhausen effects. There's something that make them feel not timeless, but of a time that is appreciated.
And another thing I wanted to bring up too is, another thing that adds to this is Burton wanted to bring Anton Furst, the same guy who designed the first sets of the first of 89 Batman, to this movie. And for some reason, schedules didn't mesh. So for the first time, he brought on Bo Welch. He's the same guy who would work on Edward Scissorhands a few years later. And I think that also benefits this film. I think if you would have had the dark tones, the dark palette that 89 Batman had, it would not have worked. And I think by lighting it the way he has, I think that it just meshes perfectly. And, of course, Bo Welch would go on to marry Catherine O'Hara, and they are still married to this day. So, not only did he get a pretty good production designer, he made a love connection as well.
Yep, he'd also work on Batman Returns. He did the production design for Men in Black. His directing career was one and done because, have you seen Cat in the Hat?
Oh, that was his? Oh, I didn't know he directed that. Sure I still haven't seen that movie.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible movie. Speaking of Alec Baldwin.
Oh, he's in that too?
He plays the villain in that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he's the evil stepdad. As if they couldn't deduce that they're dead, the camera pans to this great prop of the handbook for the recently deceased. And I love how she's like, check who published it. It's something Dead Publishing or something like that. Like, it's a very, very dry joke. Turns out the book is not as straightforward. It's sort of like reading a Stephen King book where it reads like stereo instructions half the time.
Jesus. I love that this item, this prop, 35 years later, is still being sold. It's now being turned into backpacks and notebooks. Oh, yeah. And this handbook for the recently deceased is still a merchandisable item so many decades later. It's great.
And people know what it's from. Like, it's not one of those things to where they have to put a Beetlejuice sticker on it or anything like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But even with the handbook, they're still unclear what they're supposed to do. Because as she says, like, are we in heaven? Are we in hell? Is this, like, purgatory? And he goes, I don't know, but we'll find out later. And 15 minutes into the movie, we get our first kind of look at the title character inside the model that they built, where he's looking at the newspaper. And you can sort of hear that distinctive, scruffy voice that Michael Keaton puts on for this movie. And there's a reason why he is still known for this role to this day. You will never see Michael Keaton this manic or have a showcase like this ever again.
I am really curious how he's going to be in this sequel, because there's no way he can be more manic than he is in this movie. When he grabs the newspaper, he's like, okay, let's see what's going on in the jobs section. He opens up to the obituaries. Like, that is a joke that, oh man, it had me really laughing this time watching it. He is incredible in this role. Burton is like the anti-Kubrick, right? Like, he allowed so much fucking ad-libbing in this, because almost all of this is ad-libs. And who knew that Michael Keaton had this in him? As Adam mentioned, most of the roles he had, like Mr. Mom, Night Shift, those are like sitcom type roles in movies. And here he is, he's only given about 14 and a half minutes of screen time, but he uses it all to his advantage. I had forgotten how much I liked him in this role.
And going through the who would have done this, who would have done that, especially with the Fly reference that we get here in a little bit, and the connection, Jeff Goldblum, I'm really surprised, isn't playing this role at that time.
I thought of that too, yeah.
But yeah, Keaton, it's amazing how much he embodies. And it takes balls when you're doing comedy to put yourself out there this far. And I appreciate and admire the way he does it. Because yeah, he is all sorts of letting loose in a way that I don't think he's done since. And it's phenomenal. And yeah, he's in this movie 14 minutes, and a lot of that is at the end, and he permeates all the way through pop culture to this day.
Now, Matt, he was conceptualized differently, right? He was supposed to be even more evil or something.
He was meant to be the true villain of the movie, in the sense that he was going to be like this winged demon monster who, I can't believe I'm about to say this, takes on the form of a short Middle Eastern man.
Yeah.
And rather than
Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, have you seen Tim Burton's movies? I don't think he knows what black people are.
No.
And he tries to outright murder the Dietzes, and he wants more than just marriage from Lydia in the original script. It's much more explicit.
It's Garrett.
So definitely, definitely a lot more of a demonic force in the original script than he is here, where he's kind of the Joker in a lot of ways, where he's just like this chaotic energy that just enters the movie and just fucks everything up.
He's Heath Ledger's Joker to me when I watched this movie. That was most of the connection I made, was to Heath Ledger's Joker, not necessarily Nicholson's that we'd see the year later.
But you could watch this movie and see why so many people were scratching their heads about Michael Keaton being Batman. You can't make that connection. But that line you mentioned about, let's see here, business section, and he opens it up. yes, Beetlejuice is one of my many impressions I can do, everybody. But he goes, look, they look young and stupid, too, which is one of my favorite lines.
Yes.
So the next day they wake up, and because this movie, one of the things I really appreciate it is that it tells you time has passed without visually showing it all that much outside of the house changing. That's the assumption that we're seeing time pass, because what feels like 5 minutes to them turns into 2 hours, as we'll see. Days can turn into months. And we're introduced to the Dietz family, played by, let's see, we've got Catherine O'Hara. I have to mention his name, Jeffrey Jones. And, you know, Winona Ryder, who I'm going to be a lot more positive about her on this review than I was on the Alien Resurrection review.
I was going to say, she's at least better here than she was in Resurrection.
Oh, this is like, I still think this is her best role. I think she is.
I agree.
She is so perfectly tuned in this role. So the Dietz family, were introduced to them, coming over from New York City. So Lydia is Charles's biological daughter, but Delia's a stepmom, so there's that kind of dissonance already. But I love how they're just talentless yuppies, because Delia is the conceptual artist, but everything is just ugly, and you can't see how someone would find value in it. And I'm pretty sure they cut out the scenes where Charles has to go door to door and tell people that he's a registered sex offender. That's the one part that they left out.
I gotta tell you, this whole thing about her making models and things was, I had completely forgotten about this. I love the part where they're moving her in and they put the structure on the table. It's like, that's my structure. You got to put it on perfectly. And they put it on the table and she just kind of straightens it out. Like, who knew it was supposed to stand up like that? Of course, we'll see a lot of bunch more shenanigans on the outside with the cranes and things. But this family is, in watching this movie, I had to put together, because my whole thing, a big part of my dissonance with this movie was, you know, what is the conflict here? Why is it so important that they haunt these people to the point where they move the hell out, even though, you know, they're not exactly the friendliest of people, but why is it such a big deal? Well, they're stuck here until they do it. So we have, as Matt mentioned, the Dune scene to show that, yeah, they're stuck here until they get these people out. And I liked how that all that kind of came together, as you mentioned, Matt, in a very, very short amount of time.
I can't help but think when we get Catherine O'Hara's character and all the sculptures and everything else, that it's Tim Burton. And when he goes in for a production meeting and he's bringing props, that's exactly what it's like for Tim Burton showing up at Disney, showing up at Warner Brothers, people putting it up, putting it down the wrong way. I remember a family vacation we did. We were at Disneyland Resort, California Adventure, when I think it was when Frankenweenie came out. It was either that or Corpse Bride. And they turned the animation building into Tim Burton, where it was tons of original drawings, the actual claymation figures themselves, and all these other pieces of artwork. And this feels very personal and very Tim Burton-y. I mean, you might as well put him in Catherine O'Hara, except for the red hair, and I think he'd get a good fit.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because Lydia is basically Tim Burton avatar. You know, she's gothic outsider. And this starts a thing that Tim Burton's movies, one of the themes that a lot of his movies touch on are parents who don't give a shit about their kids. And this has that. And everything that is mundane and normal are the scary things. And everything that is horrific and kind of maudlin are, you know, really sweet and saccharine. So even in this movie, which is fresh out of the gate for Tim Burton, you're seeing so many of his hallmarks, at least from a theme and story perspective, being put at the forefront.
Yeah. Can I talk about Winona Ryder real quick?
Are we allowed to air this part?
Well, yeah. I want to mention Winona Ryder. Her in this movie, and we made a joke that, yeah, she's definitely better than last week where I was pretty harsh on her. But when I think about the runner-up for this role, it was her and Alyssa Milano who were the two finalists to get this role. I'm glad they went with Winona Ryder here because I think Heather's was maybe the year after or maybe the year
same
before.
Year.
I don't, it was same year. Okay. This is the 1-2 punch for Winona Ryder and why I will always remember her as an actress is how she was able to personify both these roles. She plays this disheartened, very, yes, she's gothic, very big Burton avatar so well. I just think you feel her pain when she's being just kind of lambasted by her stepmom and her dad's not really paying attention to her. And I think, as you mentioned, Matt, I think this is her best role. Seriously, it's between this and Heather's. I'm a big fan of Heather's as well, but this is definitely up there.
But to your early question, I sympathize with the Maitlands because these people are just so in their own headspace, and like I said, I just don't like yuppies on principle.
Yeah.
So I can see why they're so hell-bent on getting these people out of their house.
But can you agree that Alyssa Milano, look, I'm a big Milano fan, don't get me wrong, but she would not have worked in this role.
I don't think it's that she wouldn't have worked. I think it's that it would have been a different kind of delivery. I don't think she would have been as sardonic
mm-hmm.
with some of her live deliveries, but let's also remember the original script, she had a sister
yeah.
who was 9, and dies during the movie.
Yeah. Another wise choice was to cut that out.
Yeah. I mean, look, this role was offered to, like, Sarah Jessica Parker. It was offered to Molly Ringwald. It was offered to my favorite, Jennifer Connelly.
I was going to say, you know what? That was the name that stuck out to me was Jennifer Connelly. I think she could have taken this on pretty well.
Yeah, but I think she would have been too old. Actually, no.
Yeah.
This would have been 2 years after Labyrinth.
Yeah. Yeah, she was about the right age.
She certainly could have done it. But originally, Delia was going to be played by Angelica Houston, but she was sick. Which is funny because Delia would have just been... She played Morticia Adams a couple years after this. It would have been the same kind of character.
Yes.
So I think conceptually it would have been a lot different. But, you know, they're moving in. I mean, they're basically acting like no one's ever lived here before. And she's got her, I guess, interior designer / spiritualist, Otho, who comes in with spray paint. And they're just like... Oh, Miriam. This guy's such a dick.
He is. He died tragically just a few years after this. I guess he fell down a flight of stairs and he had a head injury. You know what? He plays this yuppie asshole so well. I loved him in this movie.
They're trying to establish in the movie, and they do this, that people who aren't paying attention can't see the dead, I think is the way they describe it. Because, like, they open the closet, Gina Davis hung herself, but they can't see it. They open another door, Alec Baldwin severed his own head, and she's holding it.
Yeah.
And they just keep going business as usual. So I like how they're establishing that unless the living give a shit, they have no interest in seeing the dead.
Adam, do you remember, there was a video game, I think it was like you're a ghost trying to haunt a house, kind of like this, right? Where you're like going to different corners of the house, and some of the haunts work, some of them don't. I don't remember the name of that game to save my life, but do you remember this game?
I vaguely remember it. Yeah, I can't think of the title at all. But yeah, I vaguely remember what you're thinking.
That's what I was thinking of when I was watching this, was that particular game. I think it was a take on Poltergeist or something. I don't remember exactly what it was. But yeah, it's just kind of funny where they're just kind of going through all this. And she not only does she like hang herself, but she like takes her face off and everything too. And again, this is a PG movie, but the Burton effects really do play perfectly with this particular line where she's hanging and then she just rips her skin right off. It's really fun.
Well, yeah.
This is a great introduction to this level of horror for you, like a family horror or young kids type of thing. Because you've got some moments like that. They're like, ooh, but it's never over the top. And when you look at PG movies at the time, PG quote unquote horror movies at the time, this isn't Jaws. This isn't, from what I've heard, Poltergeist. Haven't seen it. It kind of threads that line, but still has some creepy moments.
Yeah. And the effects are not grotesque enough to warrant an R rating. Because they're also not going for realism. Like, everything is very exaggerated. So that's another way they get around it. As they realize, scaring people is not as easy as they think. So they consult their handbook. And, I mean, look, one of the problems with doing a Tim Burton plot synopsis is, even in a movie like this, the plot is really non-existent. Because, like I said, Tim Burton's never really had that strong of narratives. Like, his tightest movie is probably his adaptations, because he had something to stick to. I mean, Ed Wood is pretty tight. That one's pretty straightforward. But that one's also very exaggerated, so it fits. So they're trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to get into these people out of our house? Because as they find out, Lydia can see them through the window, but they lock the door. But she gets a skeleton key from the agent. So Lydia is clearly in on a supernatural presence, but the Maitlands want to make sure that they get their house back. So they draw a door. And this is another gag. Where
great gag.
She thinks it doesn't work, but he draws the knob. And the door opens, and we get, this is classic Tim Burton set design with the wide angles and the disproportionate walls. Like, it looks like that part in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where they're rolling him into the hospital.
Yes.
And everything's, you know, got that angular look. So as they find out, death in this world is just a horrible bureaucracy. Which I also love. This doesn't have a religious connotation, which is always something you have to dance around when it comes to, like, portraying the afterlife, because there's so much pop culturousness in heaven and hell. It's literally a waiting office where they walk in and it's all these other people who have died. And there's great gags of the guy smoking a cigarette, claiming he's trying to cut down himself. They get the woman at the gate, where this detail I didn't pick up until I was older, where if you commit suicide, you become a caseworker.
Yes. Another great gag. And by the way, the game I was thinking of was Haunting starring Poltergeist. For Sega Genesis. This is all pretty good stuff. It should be mentioned, too, like right before they draw that door, I mean, they do see a newspaper clipping that has Beetlejuice's name on it. So they are already aware that he is out there. And even as he's drawing the door, it's so funny because Barbara just looks at him and is like, why don't we just call that Beetle guy? Like, he lingers. He's lingering around here. And Adam is so intent on not using the Beetlejuice that he's trying so hard, but it's hopeless until they get him involved.
So they have to take a number. And she even says, like, you only get three connotations in 125 years. Like, it's basically allegory for the modern day healthcare system. So they meet their caseworker, Juno, who has the great gag of smoking through her, like, the cut in her throat.
That's fantastic.
And she's got probably my favorite line in the movie, where she talks about, be thankful you didn't die in Italy. Because they talk about how when you die, you're assigned a place to haunt. And when you think about a place like Winter River, Connecticut, not that many people have died there, so there's plenty of space. Think about somewhere like India or China. The afterlife's going to get cramped really quick.
And you know what I love about this role, too, and everybody else in this movie? What I love about this is Michael Keaton is so manic in this movie. It would have been ridiculous to have another character, another person in this movie be as manic. Everybody else plays it so dry. And so straight. And that's what makes the movie work. You know, and watching it this time, it really hit me that Michael Keaton, being as manic as he is helped by these people being straight-laced. And Juno being so dry with her deliveries is remarkable the way it works.
Yeah, she reminds me very much of Janine in Ghostbusters. You know, it's very straight-laced and kind of just that juxtaposition to what you get on the crazy and zany. Everything from when they walk through the door, from the door itself, it is so crazy, zany, wacky. It is Tim Burton-esque. You know, I've seen documentaries of Guillermo del Toro, and you walk through his house, and you're like, oh, yeah, his house is basically his mind. I feel like that's what we get with Tim Burton. As soon as we get in the waiting room, as soon as we get back here, we're walking through. Everything is just, it's amazing how pitch perfect and fun and zany. But when you look at the details, you know, there's effort into deciding how these people died, and it's, you know, you got some really dark black humor going on, and it is just chef's kiss.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's actual thought put into how the afterlife works, like the structure and the rules. The rules are pretty loose, but they give you enough of the basics where you have to remain in the house for 125 years, and if you want them out of your house, you have to force them out. You also can't reveal your existence. You know, it's kind of that Men in Black type of throwing the rug underneath so people can't see. But she also drops that Beetlejuice was once her assistant, and the only way to summon him is to say his name three times, which they should not do. Which, if you catch that, if you're commit suicide and became a caseworker, that means Beetlejuice offed himself in the past life.
Yeah.
If that's what's led to be believed, not having seen the sequel, because I know they're going to go into his backstory.
Oh, is it the backstory?
That's what I heard. I don't 100% know.
Okay.
But I also love how she lights her cigarette and evaporates in the smoke.
Great gag.
So as you mentioned, Adam and Barbara Lydia can see them, so she starts to form a relationship with them. Although they do the most cliche thing of literally putting sheets with eye holes in them.
Do they ever explain And I tried paying attention for this watch, and I did not catch it. Do they ever explain why she can see them?
She attributes it to her paranormal intuition. Okay. But also it's the thing of she's also strange and unusual like they are, so she can see them. So it's not like definitive, but that tracks, especially in the context of Tim Burton movies.
Where of course.
If you remember, if Batman Returns, I mean, they literally have plans for the Batmobile for no reason.
Look, it's not something that like really, really, really needs to be explained. I think that's an efficient enough reason. I mean, look, it's on the surface reasoning, but come on. I mean, this is such a zany film that just a small sentence like that, it's enough to please me at least.
They start to have a bit of a conversation, but once again, they can't get the Dietzes out of the house, where all they do is just decorate and the father bird watches, which, knowing Jeffrey Jones, seeing him with binoculars takes on a whole new meaning.
That oh, Jesus, stop.
In some way, they feel like they've worn out all their ability to do on their own, because they try more grotesque gags, things to be a little bit more apparently spooky, but it doesn't affect them. So they decide to summon Beetlejuice by saying his name three times, and it transports them. You know, this is a credit to the editing, how it transitions to them inside the model.
Great work, yeah. Yeah, that was a big part of the advertising, too, I seem to remember, was that particular shot.
And they literally have to dig them up. If you notice, everything is spelled like Beetlejuice, which is the star that the name is taken from, but they say it phonetically like Beetlejuice, like how it's spelled in the title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny because I remember I read something where Burton said that in a pitch where they were trying to think of the title, he came up with the title Scared Sheetless as a gag, as a joke, and the studio almost went with it. And it blew him away. So I like the fact that we have this title Beetlejuice, and you know, we've seen him already, but now is when our two main protagonists get in contact with him. Now we have the title character. This has been something that's been anticipated. We've had some character moments. We've had some zany moments. We've had these two try to do this themselves, but they realize they can't. And this is what we've been anticipating, is getting this title character involved in the story.
Other than the clip of him doing the Cal Worthington, I'm a dog spot type commercial, which if you're as old as Garrett and I,
yes,
hard. The little detail that I missed as a kid, and I remember the first time I noticed it, when they're digging them up and that they actually have the layers of the model, the different layers, the cardboard, the corrugated board. There is something beautifully wonderful about that kind of detail that doesn't matter. But even the camera's panned up back far enough that you see the layers of a model they're digging through. And that is just glorious work. It's a little thing that just, man, it's special. It's a detail that didn't need to be there, but fuck, it works.
It does. And speaking of works, he comes out literally on strings out of the grave, and he is just some Pepe Le Pew here with him being just a sexual deviant towards Barbara.
Yeah, like, it's Gina Davis. I gotta say, I can't blame him.
I love when he takes a stick and he's moving it up her dress. Yeah, this is all zany stuff. Again, PG movie too. Which really comes into play here in a little bit.
And he tells them his qualifications. He went to Juilliard. He's seen The Exorcist 167 times. It keeps getting funnier. They do the gag of him like splitting his face open. That's meant to scare them. But he's so manic and over the top that they basically refute his services. Because he's too, I guess, unpredictable is the right word.
I mean, he's trying to bang Adam's wife. I don't know if I would be keen on hiring somebody who does that, but I mean, he gave many reasons why it probably wouldn't be a good idea to hire my mom for this gig.
For sure. But he basically tells them, you know what? I don't need you guys anyway, but doesn't mean we've seen the last.
No. Are you going to mention when he kicks the tree?
Nice fucking model.
Wonderful gag. And the weird thing about this was this wasn't supposed to happen. Keaton was supposed to kick it and it wasn't supposed to move, but he kicked it for this take. And the fucking thing collapsed. And Keaton saying that was him talking to the prop guy. Hey, nice fucking model. But Burton loved it so much, he kept it in the edit, which was a brilliant choice. That is something that just happened off the cuff, like a lot of this movie. And you know what? When we talk about ad-libbing, we've talked about it in the past, boys. We've discussed movies where ad-libbing doesn't always work. But in this, it just really works. I remember I was 11 years old, and this was a PG movie. I had rented it at a friend's house, and that scene came up, and the mom was like, what did he just say? Like, you felt really bad. You felt like a bad person for watching this movie. Like, you felt like you were doing something bad, which was awesome.
Wait, because they slip it in, like, they slip it in, and it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, and like, it wasn't supposed to happen, which was the best part of it.
Because you think the scene is over, and then it ends like that. That's the beat that they cut, and they say home, 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 which has also never been established how they get out of there. That's just random luck.
Yeah, I do think the rules change a little bit with the words that they say. But yeah, that getting the nice fucking model. Like, I remember the trailer where it's just like, nice model. And I remember seeing it. And as a kid, you knew that you were watching the part that wasn't allowed. And it was, even though no parents would cut it, you knew you were getting away with watching something anytime that scene just happened to be on. It feels just, oh no, I'm seeing something I'm not supposed to see. By actually getting the F word out in such a PG movie.
And not to mention him like grabbing his crotch three times too. Like it was just like everything was like something you weren't supposed to see.
I hate and I resent so many people who were like, hey, did you know this was ad-libbed? Hey, this is an ad-libbed. And 90% of the time, it's not. They may have come up with it when they were blocking or something like that, but it's not a true ad-lib where this one was. And it's it sticks. It sticks the landing.
Well, speaking of sticking the landing, Charles is trying to get Robert Goulet, of all people. this is a weird bit of casting.
It is.
Especially because he's not involved in the big musical number coming. Yeah, Robert Goulet is the one that's not in the musical sequence.
Smells Burton.
Well, he's trying to tell him that, you know, the small town, it's got a lot of things we could do to transform it into a hotspot, but he keeps telling him, I need more. So Delia, to her credit, has a dinner party where she's got Otho, fucking Dick Cavett. It's
just, yeah.
It's so weird that people that just show up in
two movies. I know.
Is it safe to call this the most famous scene in the movie?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it really is like impressive choreography when you watch it and see how much has to go into that. But yeah, it's cool, but you know, it's just weird that the movie stops to have a big Harry Belafonte musical number.
Strange that this got approved and got passed. Tim Burton today, yeah, he's going to say he's going to do it, and he's going to do it. This Tim Burton at this point in his career, it's amazing this gets through.
So this is the reveal that the supernatural exists. So this is kind of getting the wheels in motion for getting Robert Goulet to show up and transform the town. But Lydia's not too pleased about having to sell out the Maitlands. And because of that, we get a scene that was left over from the original movie where he turns into a snake.
Yes.
This was in the original script to the point to where they, in later production, changed it to make it actually look like Michael Keaton because this was shot earlier before they rewrote the script.
Matt, did you get major Kraven vibes from this in Nightmare 3?
Oh, this is straight out of Dream Warriors.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of. That's in my notes.
And this is also where the sister was supposed to die, where she gets attacked. Instead of a snake, it's like a giant squirrel monster.
Yeah.
Like that original script is insane. Like,
it is. It would have been an R-rated movie for sure.
But, and this is also like the most horrific thing in the movie. And also, like, they have to be very clear that he's not killing them because they cut to him dropping them on the ground. But the way it's revealed where she's stroking the balcony and then you realize it's snake skin, like it's really well, that transition's really well done.
Yeah, a lot of really good transitions in this movie. Something I had completely forgotten about.
And what they also do is they go back to Juno, and one of my favorite gags in the movie is this football team.
Yes.
Coach, I don't think we survived the crash. I'm not your coach. So she tells them, basically, you did everything wrong. You summoned Beetlejuice. You couldn't get them out of your house. So now you have to try again. This is where we get them stretching their faces to look like freaking... He looks like the dog from Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, that's what I thought of. Yeah, how can you not?
I love these prosthetics. This work is amazing. These masks are fantastic. And the voice acting that Baldwin and Davis still put through, like there's something sweet to it. But man, I love the scene of watching them stretch their face out and get this design.
And I also love how they look all horrible, but they have just the most mundane conversation. Like, again, it's that whole thing of everything that's, you know, scary is actually really sweet, vice versa, because...
I mean, this head that he puts on, I almost thought of like Pyramid Head from Silent Hill. It kind of had that feel to it as well.
Jesus.
You know?
It takes a moment to also, you know, that they say that, you know, hey, we need to do this, but what about Lydia? They're good people here.
Yeah, because they realize she's not in a family that pays any attention to her whatsoever. They don't have kids.
Exactly.
So, you know, there is an actual like emotional heart to this movie that on the surface is all aesthetic, which again is a knock you can put on, I guess, a lot of Tim Burton movies. I don't think it applies to this one. So this is where Tim Burton's problem shows up, though. He doesn't know how to end a movie. At least this is better executed than a lot of his other ones. You know, there's no Vicki Vale being let into the Batcave type of moment in this movie. But it's, okay, how do we end the movie? So we're going to have the big sales pitch, and Otho conducts a seance that turns out to be an exorcism.
We have criticized his endings in the past. I don't think this is one of those bad endings, though. I think this is one of those things where it's the movie has been so zany that we have to find a way to end it. And this whole seance thing and the way Beetlejuice rumbles his way in to try to marry Lydia, which that was me when I was a kid, like wanting to be Beetlejuice here, wanting to marry her. Like, I think this all works well. I think Burton has a tendency to get thrown off narrative and go completely out there like he did in Planet of the Apes earlier this year that we covered. But here, I think everything that is done here, I think it's pretty well executed, the way he's trying to end it.
You're saying he tried to do this when he was younger. He means 2 weeks ago with Winona Ryder, not as a child. It's funny. It definitely, I don't think, holds the same type of either narrative structure or just the same type of momentum that the film does up to this point. But I do think that there's a lot that they hold on to, and maybe because everything kind of explodes at once with the effects and some of the other stuff coming together. And I mean, it's not as strong, but man, it's still a fun time.
And Adam, I'll go with you on that. I think that's the key word is momentum. And I do think momentum is lost here when they're doing this. But this movie hasn't stayed on one thing for longer than 2 minutes, the entire film. And he's trying to light it differently. You know, we have a whole bunch of effects and things coming at us. You know, I mean, goddamn, at one point, Beetlejuice turns into this whole carnival merry-go-round. Like, there's a whole bunch of different shit going on. But the momentum is lost when you get your characters in a situation like this.
And to his credit, everything actually converges in this third act. It's not a bunch of disparate plot points coming together. Sure. Everything's been pretty connected. And again, this movie's only 90 minutes, so it doesn't have a lot of one way to do a lot of side plots.
For anybody that hasn't seen Dumbo, this isn't the only time that Michael Keaton and Tim Burton show up to a circus.
No, Batman Returns is a circus.
Oh, shit, that's right. Damn, you know what? This is, yeah, maybe Tim Burton is just like King in some of the stuff that keeps coming back.
Oh, yeah, there is. So, with no other options, Lydia goes to Beetlejuice of all people, and he says, I'll help you if you marry me, because that's the only way he can get out of whatever the afterlife is classified as.
This is when we don't really understand the rules very much, but it's okay. But if you delve into it, you're like, why does this, how come when you say this word three times, but you say that word three times, there's some stuff to pick apart, but I think when you're watching it, you don't care.
Speaking of picking apart, one of the best changes is he's not actively looking to have sexual intercourse with Lydia like he is in the original script.
Yeah, in the original script, he was, as we mentioned, he's much more of a monster, I guess you could say. And, you know, he's much more malevolent. And here, he's just zany enough. I mean, look, he's a fucking hornball. We got that earlier in the film. But here, he's just trying to marry this girl. And I think that's really funny.
Even Tim Burton's like, she's a minor. That's off. Jeffrey, that's off limits.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, she was 15 when she did this, which is crazy.
Yeah, I know. That's also crazy. So she has to play a game of charades, and I love how they just use this. He summons a thing of orange juice, which is kind of cheating, because in charades you're not supposed to have props. But he goes, it's showtime, which is like one of the big trailer lines of the movie, and he proceeds to come in with, he literally turns the third act into a carnival, where he turns two of them into like those things you hit with the hammer, and it shoots up and rings the bell.
I remember seeing Barbara and Adam decay like this was kind of disturbing to me as a child when I watched it. I remember being kind of scared by that. There was an episode of The X-Files where Mulder and Scully get on this ship, and the remnants of that ship made them grow old. And you see Mulder and Scully just get old in front of you. And I remember watching that and thinking of this particular scene, because every time I see stuff like this, it disturbs me.
Yeah, it's basically, how is it this looks better than the end of Last Crusade? And that
Crusade was only a year later.
Yeah, but that was made with a lot more money.
That's true. So I wouldn't say it looks a lot better. Again, this is, yeah, it's less money. I don't think the old effects hold up as much as, I mean, Last Crusade was its own thing. Let's not get back into that conversation, but I think they're on par. I'll go that far.
Yeah.
I think they do a great work with the lighting and the camera angles they use, and it's not overly done as much. So yeah, those effects are just enough. And yeah, to your point, like just watching them age and watching them, it's just, you suddenly start to feel for them. Like there's a sentimentality in this movie that is obviously overlooked for good reason, but it's in there. Tim Burton does have a heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So once Beetlejuice saves the Maitlands, he goes, wait, we had a deal. And this literally a minister just comes out of nowhere to officiate the wedding. And he pulls out a wedding ring and he goes, "She meant nothing to me."
I'm thinking that is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
I hope not. Because not every gag needs a fucking explanation. That's what I hate.
No, nothing needs an explanation. But I tell you what, we've gone over a lot of our favorite characters in this movie, but I think my favorite character might be this guy who's conducting the marriage. I might have somebody dressed like him to conduct our marriage.
If I was like, it's basically the speed this up, I have somewhere to be. It's like a Vegas wedding, for all intents and purposes. But ceremony gets broken up by Sandworm Ex Machina. That just eats Beetlejuice, and that's the last we see of him until the final scene.
I always assumed that she had said Beetlejuice 3 times, and I realized this time she doesn't. Barbara only says it twice. You know, you got a lot of really good practical effects here in this last little bit. That zipper that Gina Davis has, image stuck with me for so long. There's something just wonderful about the practicality of the way that it comes across. But this ending is so damn fun.
It's so wonderful when she unzips it and she starts talking and he just throws a big metal fucking plate over it.
Giant, like, plate.
You don't know how many times I've wanted to do that to certain people in my life.
So they decide to basically share the house at this point. So they learn to, you know, this is thematically, you know, story resolution for the Maylands, but they have to learn to become part of some society again. They can't just be on their house to themselves, so there's at least closure for that. And they sort of become the parents to Lydia, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, what goes on here? This is one thing, we talk about endings, this is one thing I was really confused about. Did they adopt her? Did they just take her in?
They're just the they're the Uncle Jesse of the house now, where they do all the actual, they do all the actual nice parenting.
Or Uncle Owen Aunt Beru, maybe?
Yeah, except the ending is less horrific. As far as we know, who knows, they might be dead in the sequel, and that's how they explain why they're not in it, because I highly doubt they're going to be in this new one. The movie has to end with another fucking Harry Belafonte song, which involves
give him that paycheck.
Yep, another dance sequence, and then Beetlejuice is now stuck in the waiting room. He tries to switch his number with a medicine doctor, and he gets his head shrunk to close the movie.
One of my favorite gags in the entire movie is when he switches the numbers and he goes, "Oh, looks like I'm next." One of my favorite deliveries in this movie is that.
He says, "Hey, look at that."
Yeah. And of course, these legs that he's kind of fondling right before he does that, these are the legs of Tim Burton's girlfriend at that time. Of course, he has to put his girlfriends in all his films. This is just a fun way to end it. But going back to her singing, so her reward for getting a good grade, but not too good grades, is she's able to just sing and fly in the ceiling? Okay.
It's, I guess spirit possession is a perk.
Spirit possession. Okay.
Which also is paying off one of the lines that Beetlejuice has in his commercial about getting a free demon possession with every exorcism.
Which, you know, if my kid comes home and they had to fight for a C, I don't know how well that reward's going to go. I mean,
I know. That's what I'm thinking. Wow, this is pretty high reward for that. My dad would give me a freaking bop with a fucking newspaper, but that was just my dad.
I mean, it goes close to the Breakfast Club ending where, you know, your goth girl's not completely a goth girl anymore, but thank God it doesn't go that far.
Yeah, good call.
I mean, well, this movie was made by a simple mind, so.
Oh, fuck. Jeez.
And on that plentiful, punerific note, that's our review of Beetlejuice. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give this movie? Let's go to the guy the movie's named after, Adam. Partially.
Beetlejuice has been a movie that, for most of my life, has just existed. And I got to say, I'm glad that it does. It puts me in a mood for fall, Halloween, much in the way of like Nightmare Before Christmas, which isn't a Tim Burton movie, but we'll discuss that one day. This just kind of has a place in a certain time of year where things start to happen. And I think that is something that really has helped its longevity and its stick-to-itiveness, that it's there. And it's not just something that you roll out just because. It's not just habit. I fucking love this movie. It's fun. It's inventive. It really takes some balls to attempt to do what this movie does in the way of its art design, the characters that are in it. Michael Keaton just really going for the gusto. And just every moment that he's on screen, he eats every scene that he's in like there's no tomorrow. And he doesn't overstay his welcome, which is appreciated But everybody in this movie is amazing. From Alec Baldwin, and I think the only other time I've said that is in The Departed, Gina Davis, this is where the crush started, and I'm glad I got to meet her, you know, much later on in life. But everybody in this, Catherine O'Hara is spot on. Winona Ryder is absolutely amazing. She's phenomenal. Those big Disney princess doe eyes that she brings in this film. I know why my best friend got just hooked from day one. This is delightful. Are there little things I could pick apart? Yeah, sure. Do I know why when the door opens up, they're on Saturn? Nope, no idea. I don't care either. And if you pay attention, it is Saturn. There's one line that's just like, oh, I see you've been to Saturn. It's not Sandy, but okay. It is Tim Burton to the max, much like Animaniacs. It's a roller coaster of fun from start to end. It is paced amazingly well. It is edited just phenomenally. And for a 90-minute film, it is one of those that you can put on at any time. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to have a fun time. And there's a reason that it's a generational type of film. You can sit a family together and grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, and the kids are all going to enjoy parts of this film. And I think that makes it special. I never thought I would say this going into it. This film's a 9 on 10 for me. I was surprised when I wanted to sit down and evaluate just how much I fucking love this film. And I truly do. And there's a lot of Tim Burton movies I'll pick apart and we'll do them one day. But this isn't one of them. 9 on 10 for Beetlejuice.
9 on 10 for Adam. Garrett, the guy who said he didn't really care for this movie growing up. Have your thoughts changed now that you're older?
Well, 2 years ago, we did pick apart 2 Tim Burton films, and this year we picked apart another Tim Burton film. So this is the 4th Tim Burton film we have evaluated for this podcast, soon to be 5, but we'll get to that film next week. You know, when I watch these films, I log it on Letterboxd. And for those who follow me, I log every single film I watch on Letterboxd. And when I logged this one, I saw that the last time I'd watched it, which was 2014, I gave it 2.5 stars. You know what? In watching it this time, I don't know if it was just because of the crazy week that I have had personally, or all the dread that was kind of literally coming down the mountain towards us at one point, and we were scared for our property and everything else. Like, I don't know if it was that, but watching this movie after that crazy week, after Jen had gone to work, I sat down on the couch, I watched this on Max, and I had a much better time than I remember having any time I've watched this film. I think this film is paced perfectly. You can pretty much cut and paste everything Adam said. I'm going to probably say everything the same, but it's paced very well. It's 90 minutes. It goes by quick. Yeah, there is a Winona factor. And yes, this was the movie that I watched that I just pretty much fell in love with her in. And there's a reason. She really lights up the screen with her presence. I think you can really interject yourself as her in this movie and find yourself really getting deep into what she is going through as a teenager. You know, her parents aren't paying attention to her, but this ghost and these two ghosts who had just died are. She's craving that attention. And I love the fact that, you know, they don't go too deep into that. I'm glad this didn't turn into a Wes Craven horror film. I'm glad this turned into a Tim Burton zany romp. And yes, there are so many things you can pick apart in this movie. But you know what? Why do that? Sometimes, even as the harsh, you know, I get criticized for being the harsh critic that I am sometimes on these films. But sometimes you just want to sit down and have a good time. And that's exactly what this movie is. All that being said, it is a 7. You know, I can't go high. I can't go as high as a 9, which, wow, shocked we had that on this show. Maybe next week. But I'm going for a 7 just because there are so many things to like about it. But yet, it's not one that would hold up if you were to critically analyze it. But as a straight watch, it is a 7 on 10. Just pop this in and enjoy it and prepare yourself for the film we're going to review next week.
Well, I have the same score written down as one of you. Not going to say which one just yet. But I think this movie speaks to the importance of directors in that I think a lot of directors could have taken the script and we would have gotten something pretty comparable. Wes Craven, I really think Joe Dante, you would have gotten something pretty similar. But it's at the same time distinctly Tim Burton, and I think that's why I think this movie works as well as it does, surprisingly. Because it doesn't have a lot of the things that I criticize his later movies for having. It's tight. It's got likable characters. It's very well paced, which I can't say about all of his movies. And almost all the jokes hit. I mean, we haven't even talked about the scene where he goes into a poorhouse in that model, which, remember, Adam built that model. So maybe he's got they should find a marriage counselor in the afterlife based on that. The fact that it's called Dante's Inferno just makes me laugh, too.
And Baldwin built that model, everybody. Baldwin.
And I hate that Men in Black 2 literally stole that joke with the aliens in the New York train station closet or locker. This movie's been imitated a lot, but I don't think anyone's gotten close as far as this type of story. And remember, this was the most amount of money I've ever seen up until this point of a budget being spent on effects for a comedy. And it kicked off that trend, you know, because Who Framed Roger Rabbit would be a pioneering in visual effects. Jim Carrey's The Mask was a huge step forward in blending special effects into a comedy. So I think this movie was a trendsetter. And more importantly, this is why, for better or worse, Tim Burton is the name that he is. And it's also, I think, accessible for all ages. I don't think we give kids enough credit for their ability to handle certain things. Like, I don't think there's anything in this movie that I would, outside of like an F-bomb and that joke about Dante's Inferno. Certainly, if they don't know, it'll go over their heads, but it's one of those things where I'm not going to shun them for if I have to explain that. You know, it's not one of those, I can't dance around it. So I think it's also great comfort food. Like, anytime I watch this movie, I just have a smile on my face and it puts me in the fall mood, even though it's still freaking 80 degrees here, which I can't stand. I am so ready for my sweaters and my hot coffee and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to give this a 9 as well. And I think if you twist my arm, I still think this is my favorite Tim Burton movie. He's made some other stuff I've liked a lot, but I don't think anything's come close to this. And also, for the record, this is still one of the best posters that's ever been designed. So all in all, I'm giving this a 9. It's a high watermark for Tim Burton, and that's partially why I'm kind of skeptical about this new one.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So it's a new one. Now, by the time we review it, it will be out probably about a month at that time. I'm curious to know how they're going to follow this up and why it took so long to do this. I know the two guys who worked on Smallville, they also worked on the script for this, and they worked on Wednesday. But I have no idea what to expect, honestly. All I know is that Catherine O'Hara, Michael Keaton, and Winona Ryder are back. That's all I know.
Yep, and it seems like really it was Alan Miles' work on Wednesday with Tim Burton that made them all go, you know what, we think we can do this together. And I don't know what to expect. My expectations are pretty low, like they are for decades-old sequels. But if it made Tim Burton want to do a sequel, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but he hasn't done one.
Right? Not since Batman Returns.
Batman Returns. Yeah, I guess that's a sequel. It's almost a villain offshoot. So it's been, 32 years since he's done a sequel? And the first one of something that's categorically his? Damn. I mean, we'll see.
My expectations are about as small as that miniature house in the model of the town. I think legacy sequels, I am sick of them. I'm so done with this trend. Much like Beetlejuice, I need someone to say their name 3 times so they get sucked into the afterlife and I don't have to talk about them anymore. More importantly, a comedy legacy sequel, because that worked so well for Dumb and Dumber.
Oof, busters.
I think that's the hardest sell, is doing a comedy sequel, which are already notoriously difficult. I mean, some of the worst movies of all time, in certain estimations, are comedy sequels, like Caddyshack 2 is infamous.
Yeah, and I've always had a rule, I don't want to do comedies on this particular podcast. This is one exception, because I think it's just as much a zany horror film as it is a comedy. But you're right, following it up is hard. But I will say, after Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, I'm a little more optimistic than I think both of you. I'm going into this pretty optimistic, and it's getting pretty good word of mouth. So I am not paying attention to any reviews, nothing. I have not seen a word of it yet, but I'm not going to say excited, but I'm kind of curious to know exactly, as Adam said, what exactly it was that Tim Burton, Winona Ryder, and Michael Keaton and Catherine O'Hara saw that made them want to come back to this.
At the time that we're recording this one, we can say Beetlejuice is a hit. We may get that third name, or we may get the one that I've always been dreading. We may figure out whatever happened to Edward up on that hill, you know, because if this is a legacy sequel, maybe you bring back Winona and we figure out whatever happened to Mr. Scissorhands, would dread, because then you do tackle his best film.
I love that film to pieces. I don't want to see any extra part of it.
I hate to say it, I don't think it holds up that well.
I watched it just last Christmas, and I have a real fondness for that film for different reasons. I love that movie.
I'm also the guy who loves Mars Attacks. I know Adam hates that fucking movie.
I will I'll take a baseball bat to that movie.
I gotta tell you, though, I gotta say, Sleepy Hollow, though, is the one I watch almost every Halloween, because it's such a It's got the perfect atmosphere. And yeah, I wonder if this new Beetlejuice is going to have that type of aesthetic, where it's going to be a little bit more washed out. And definitely seems like there's a bigger cast just based on, I mean, you got Monica Bellucci, you got Willem Dafoe, Justin Theroux. Like, they're adding a lot of big names.
Oh, he put his girlfriend in this one, too? Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which, if you've seen the trailer, well, I won't spoil.
Don't say it, because Garrett hasn't. I know, no. But yeah.
Like, I spoil, but yeah, if my pessimism is starting to kick in. But if it's good, I will be the first here to say I was wrong and I'm surprised. But
you did with Kingino and the Planet of the Apes, and let's not forget that.
Yeah, but I will also say that was, in a certain way, continuing a franchise, not necessarily a hard reboot. Like, that movie's as much of a sequel as it is a reboot.
Yeah, that's true.
And you're talking only 5 years versus 35. So until next week, where we talk about Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, great title, by the way. Let's turn on the podcast and see what shakes loose. Thank you, gentlemen.
Astrid found this in the attic.
Ew. So?
So? Every now and then, I feel his presence, like he's lurking somewhere, just out of reach. But lately, I'm seeing him again. And I was really hoping this was all in my head, but now this.
Lydia, you need to take back your life. From the hanger-oners, from this thing. Where is the obnoxious little goth girl who tormented me all those years ago? It's time to find her.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Boy, do you know how to pick up. Let me ask you something. Is this relationship really solid? Do I have a shot at her at all?
Excuse me.
Sure. Am I overstepping my bounds? Just tell me. Come on.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Are you Juno, our caseworker?
Yes, I evaluate individual cases and determine if help is needed, deserved, and available.
Are you available?
No.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, The Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars, Pirates of the Caribbean, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
What are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it!
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
We just want to get some people out of our house.
Ah, I understand. Well, look, in order to do that, I'm really going to have to get to know you guys. You know, we got to get closer. Move in with you for a while. Get to be real pals. You know what I'm saying? And
it truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
We're like peas in a pod, the three of us. Let's face it, you want somebody out of the house, I want to get somebody out of your house.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You hate him, right? I hate him myself! Come on, kids, what do I have to do to strike a deal with you two, huh?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You bunch of losers! How dare you hear out the professional while he's working!
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Nice fucking model!
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual, Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
This is a safe space, okay? Feel free to express yourself. Don't be afraid. I sense there's an enabler here, but we'll get to that.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
God, you guys really are dead.
The Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Oh, I've got to go.
Which is crazy with this being so attached to ABC Freeform Disney, and it's not a Disney film. In fact, this is only a few years after Disney fired him.
Yep, this was the man who worked on The Black Cauldron.
And one of my favorites. Stay tuned.
He's got the most unlikable protagonist in the history of Disney.
That's, you know what? That's because he... you know what? Never mind. People read the books. Taron's not the protagonist by the end of the series. I love it.
Well, that explains why Tim Burton didn't make Batman the protagonist of his own movie. I mean, that's kind of in common with this. It's funny, this opening reminds me so much of Hocus Pocus, which came out a couple years after this, with the font on the names and things like that, as you're seeing a above floor angle, just reminds me of that a lot.
I've never seen Hocus Pocus, believe it or not.
I'd be curious to know your take, because that thing is like, much like this, got a sequel 30 years later.
Plays nonstop on Disney's 13 days.
That's my question. How did you avoid it?
I don't know.
Years ago, for the first time.
It is Mick Garris. Mick Garris did work on that script, and he talks about that a lot.
He didn't direct
it. You,
no.
You think Hocus Pocus for the intro, to me, I'm like...
On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give this movie? Let's go to the guy the movie's named after, Adam. Partially.
It's amazing because as I was rewatching it for this, I go, you know, that would be a really easy kind of costume to pull off when we go to Universal Horror Nights this year. Just, you know, get some brown pants and that checkerboard shirt. So Adam may be cosplaying as Adam from Beetlejuice because that's as simple as it gets. And I can't believe there's no Beetlejuice house at Universal. They done fucked up Halloween Horror Nights. Come on. Come on.
You know how expensive that would be?
They did it like 3 years ago. When there wasn't a movie tie-in.
I don't know.
Beetlejuice has been a movie that